Well, it's certainly my pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to present. And Tony, I love the segue. You've set me up wonderfully for my presentation today. I feel like a little bit like I'm preaching to the choir here being at the ASA meetings and presenting this. I think we're all well aware what cellulosic biomass is. I'm going to focus this talk mostly on cellulosic, not much on the grain component of ethanol, and not even just focusing on the ethanol itself. Cellulosics can be anything from corn stalks. Corn stalks certainly are getting a lot of attention. They're going to, if you're aware at all of the billion ton report, they're certainly on the docket. But there's other things. You can have biomass soybeans, biomass corn, perennial grasses, wheat, you know, just a whole host of things that would fall into this category, and that's not even looking at forest products, which would be the other component as well. Well, what have we used this for? Well, historically, we've been using our biomass products for a long time. Animal bedding, animal food. If you go back historically, very little biomass was left on the field. That was harvested and brought in either for animal bedding, for food. It was removed from the field. Nice little tidbit that I learned on the way is that Stover got its name because it got stuffed into the stove, hence Stover. It was burned. And there's places across the world where grain and plants residues are still used for home cooking, home heating. It's been incorporated as a green manure. Now, the difference with a green manure is that the idea is to have a low carbon nitrogen ratio so that you're after the nitrogen as opposed to some of the other organic materials that are left where you have a high carbon to nitrogen ratio and you're after the carbon more so. Historically, it's also very important for erosion management. Some of the newer interest is taking this materials and converting it into liquid fuels. The cellulosic ethanol production. There's been tons of talks at these meetings and across the country looking at using these materials to make ethanol, making liquid fuels. We're well aware of the rising costs of petroleum, of the problems with that, so we have the sugar platform, taking the cellulosic products and turning that into ethanol. Something you probably haven't heard quite as much about is some of the thermochemical processes. These are controlled combustion. That you could have gasification, where you can get dimethyl ether, which is a precursor that you can use for making diesel. And there's also as replacement for natural gas. In my personal experience, this is the area this is coming online now. This is now technology. It's not 5 or 10 years technology. The plants to do some of this replacement with natural gas are hitting the ground. At the University of Minnesota Morse, which is across the street basically from my facility at ARS, is installing, ground was broken this summer, they're putting in a biomass boiler to replace their natural gas, or at least a component of it, for heating the campus. They started this process when you've seen that slide a while back about this high spike in natural gas. They're trying to get a handle on their control of these prices. The other place that I'm seeing this hit the ground is the local ethanol plant. They've been making ethanol from grain. They've got 900 some farmer producers that are on contract with them, and they are putting into place a biomass gasifier to replace natural gas. The ground has been broken on that. Been working with them, trying to come up with some recommendations for their farmers, because some of these farmers remember the Dust Bowl. They might have been little kids, but they remember the problems that happen when you don't take care of the soil. And they're very cautious about harvesting their corn stalks. They want to do it right. They want to protect their legacy, which is the land. And then finally, there's also the pyrolysis, where you can get bio-oils, biochar, and the reason bio is there is depending on the conditions, it may still have some biologically active properties, and also biogas. So these are other energy type pathways that can be used. And then there's all this whole host of biomass products. I mean, sometimes we forget about the fact that, well, what are fossil fuels? Well, they're really, really, really old plants. So when we look at some of these biomass type things, whether it's grain ethanol or from the cellulosic, we're just trying to crunch down the timeline there. Now, there are benefits and risks, no matter what technology you're looking at. Some of the benefits of going to some of these biomass-type products is, one, we can grow it in our own backyard. It's renewable. We don't have to import it from places around the world where they don't like us very much. I mean, that's pretty obvious that some of these places, one, they don't like us, and two, they're not very stable. If it's done right, there's a good chance that we can actually reduce the amount of fossil fuel. Yes, you can do it, so you're not getting that greenhouse gas benefit, but as these technologies improve and we're cognizant of that, there are ways we can improve that as well. And I've heard this rumbling that there may come a point where the corn stalk or the stover of some of these or the crop residues may be just as valuable as the grain itself. I'm going to focus most of my talk of looking at some of the risks. These biomass materials, these crop residues, I don't like to use the word waste. You know, how many people have seen this ad that shows the farmers with the big bales of straw and it's turning waste into energy or something? I'm just like, oh, cringe, this is not waste, this is valuable material. We know that if we take these materials off, you leave the land exposed, you're increasing your risk for erosion. If you're taking those inputs off, you're setting yourself up to lose soil organic matter. If you lose soil organic matter, you have erosion, you're going to lose productivity. We're also going to be removing nutrients. If you're taking off potassium, if we were just discussing, you're going to set yourself up to having problems. You've got to be very careful about how much is going off. I suggest that one of the reasons we may be seeing some huge variation in what's coming off is might be that if you just take the entire plant, you take a grab sample, it's going to make a difference on whether you're at the bottom of that plant or the top. So there's a lot of things that still need to be looked at. Let's take a look at what this material can do for us. What is it going to do for the soil? How do we need this? Well, we're going to protect the soil from erosion. I'm going to look at this a little more closely in a moment. Because that material is on the ground, it's protecting the soil either from wind or water. We're also providing the inputs, the raw materials, into the system. We have to feed the organisms. If you don't have any life in your soil, it's just dirt. It's not soil. It's not viable anymore. So we have to provide the nutrients, whether that's organic materials and for the carbon base, but as other nutrients as well, to feed and support the below ground system. As we do that, a small percent is actually going to stay in the soil to build the soil organic carbon. Most of the soil organic carbon is going to be derived from root material. Depending on the system you're in, it can be anywhere from 60 to 90% of the carbon that gets converted into soil organic matter came from the roots. But nonetheless, we have to have some of that above ground material as well. Let's talk a little bit about erosion. We've got a man-made thing, the tillage, and we're going to come back to that in just a minute. But we also have wind and water. As you have open fields, now look at these locations. This is Indiana. This is not a place where you normally think of wind erosion as being a major problem. But this haze in the background, let's see, where'd my mouse go? There we go. Is soil particles. Here we also see suspended soil particles. This stuff built up against the side of this car is soil. It's not snow, it's soil. And this is a phenomenon that I see in my backyard. This is called snert. We get it in Minnesota and in South Dakota when you have, yeah, it's snert. It's snow plus dirt. And what happens is that under these cold, dry conditions, the soil becomes freeze-dried. You get the driving winds. There's nothing to stop it, and it drifts and blows. And sometimes you get some beautiful artwork, but we've displaced our soil. And when we displace our soil, it's not on the fields. It ends up in the waterways. It's carrying pesticides, nutrients, things that are good on our fields, bad in the waterways. Like I said, I'm preaching to the choir. You know this. Also, if you have exposed soil and you get high incident rainfalls, there's nothing to stop the energy in that rain from displacing the soil. And as you can see in these photos, there's not much residue on those soils. There's not much biomass to collect that, and as a result, you end up with some huge water movement. How does tillage fit in? Well, if we have the crop materials, but we bury them, they're not providing much residue. We also have this phenomenon of tillage erosion in and of itself. Gravity works. So when you till the soil and get to the ode to the pole, where you have, where it's gone around, you see the pole standing up there. We have the bald spots, kind of like the growing bald spot on a middle-aged man, where you have displacement from soil at the top of the hill. Gravity works, it's been tilled, it gets lifted up, it moves downhill. And as you can see, these graying areas are kind of moving down. What happens eventually is that the subsoil begins to bury the topsoil, and you're losing productivity. Let's shift gears just a little bit and look at carbon storage. What are the values of the carbon? We know the value of protecting the soil from erosion. Now let's shift and look a little bit at carbon. Now I understand completely that when we're storing carbon, it's not just carbon. You have all the other things that come along with it, that it's organic matter. But sometimes it's easier to measure carbon than it is to try to get a measure of organic matter. Well, we're going to try to build humus, which is that entire collective. It's critical for nutrient cycling, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, sulfur, the micronutrients. The water holding capacity, and connected with that, if you have it on the surface, is the infiltration. The improved soil aggregation. And when you put these all together, you can improve productivity. And if we're going to put the demands on our soil to not only produce food and feed and fiber and fuel, we better be taking really, really good care of our soil, because the amount of area that we have available to farm is decreasing every year. And kind of an extra little thing here, my other hat I wear is in global climate change, is we want to be able to move that carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and get it into the soil. Pretty well documented that we've had some substantial changes in the amount of soil organic carbon. At some point in time in history, intensive agriculture begins, and we have a decrease of anywhere from 20 to 70% in the amount of soil organic carbon in our soils. That's a lot. Let me put that in perspective for you. There's some work that was looked at in historic amounts. Up until probably the late 1960s or early 1970s, the largest amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere was not from burning fossil fuels. It was coming from soils due to change in land use and from plowing and tillage and release of this carbon into the atmosphere. Now, if we've got this system here, we're rocking along, we've come sort of to some kind of declining change, and if we impose removal of stover or other inputs, what are we going to do to our soil carbon levels? Well, if we don't do anything to offset this and we just go out and take it all, chances are we're going to continue to degrade those soils. At least, we need to try to at least maintain, and preferably, is there some way that we can offset, whether that's through expanding the length of our growing season, taking advantage of the early spring and the late fall, maybe that's cover crops. Can we do something by changing tillage practices? Can we do something by diversifying our rotations? What can we do differently so we can have our soil carbon and our biomass too? Here's a fantastic quote by Dr. Bill Larson. He's one of my heroes. He was looking at this whole idea of harvesting biomass after the oil embargoes in the 70s. And his conclusion was, is first we take care of the soil. Once we've taken care of the soil, if there's some left, then you can use that for other purposes. Take care of your resource first. Take care of your baseline. Protect your principle. Now, what that minimum amount is, what we need to protect it, is not a static thing. There's not a one-size-fits-all. For one thing, we have to deal with climate and weather. As you move north to south, the rate of decomposition is different. The reason we have wonderful black soils in Minnesota is because decomposition is slower than the rate of input. So we've been able to, historically, these soils have built up. Before they were broken with the plow and taken out of prairie production, some of these soils had 6% organic matter. It's a lot of carbon in there. Now they're probably down in the range of 2 to 3 on average. Also, as you move from west to east, you have a change in relative precipitation. So if you're in the west where it's drier, again, the amount of carbon that you need to maintain tends to be less than as you move east. So by the time you get down into the southeast, you almost have to have continuous inputs at all times just to maintain your soil organic matter. But I've seen some wonderful studies by incorporating of cover crops. They're able to do a very nice job of maintaining their soil organic carbon. The other thing that's going to make a difference on how many inputs you need or how much what your minimum carbon is what's your nitrogen fertilization rate. Now, this is a complex one. It's not a simple, you keep putting nitrogen in, you're automatically going to increase the amount of soil organic carbon. There's some evidence that it's a little more complicated than that. It's a biological system. We shouldn't be surprised. One, you have to have enough nitrogen fertilizer in there to maintain your biomass and maintain your grain yield. But remember that much of your carbon, soil organic carbon, is derived from the roots. Roots respond differently to nitrogen fertilizer than above ground material. You're going to get more bang for the buck in the grain than you are in the stover or in the roots. The other complicating thing is that as you add nitrogen, if you were in a nitrogen-limiting situation for decomposition and you have excess nitrogen there, now you can accelerate decomposition. So you have opposing forces and different things going on, particularly with nitrogen. So it makes it more complicated. Residue management. What type of tillage are you doing? There's a tendency as you go from intensive mobile plowing to no-till to decrease the loss into as CO2, or otherwise looking at as increased soil organic carbon. Going from rotational crops into CRP, which is taking things out of grain production, putting them into set-aside acres, growing perennial species, you tend to increase soil organic carbon. Again, we're looking at some complicated things. As you leave residue on the surface, you change the microclimate. You change the infiltration rate. You change soil temperature. In cold, wet climates in Minnesota, the northern part of the Corn Belt, that can be very detrimental. It's hard sell to get farmers to go to no-till because of the problem with the cold, wet soils. If you go further west and further south, that residue, because it saved moisture, kept things a little cooler, actually has a very positive response on productivity. So again, they're complicated, but we would like to shift to less tillage. Maybe that means a zone tillage or strip tillage. How do we build carbon in the soil? How do we build this biomass? Well, a very simple equation. Inputs must exceed outputs if you want to grow the amount that's stored. Now, this is incredibly deceiving because it's very difficult to predict, particularly the outputs. We know where the inputs are coming from. We can very easily measure above ground. Roots are far more challenging to get at. Anybody that's done a root study usually has done it once. And then they learn their lesson and go, oh man, this is just too much work. But nonetheless, that's an incredibly important part of getting at the carbon inputs. And then there's the manure aspect. And granted, that may be transporting the materials from one place to another, but manure is really just slightly processed plant material. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, and we'll let John talk more about it. But then you also have the outputs. Respired carbon. We can have the displacement from erosion, the tillage, leaching, and let's not forget harvest. And if we're going to start harvesting biomass, that's also a large export. Well, how much is enough? That's the magic question. That's the $6,400 question that everybody wants to know the answer to. How much of this material can I harvest? Or, as I like to look at it, and with my colleagues we'd like to look at it, how much do we need to protect that soil? how much is enough to make sure that we're taking care of our soil? Well, are we going to use which constraining factor? How much do we need for soil organic matter or soil organic carbon? If we're managing for carbon, are we also managing for erosion or vice versa? What about the nutrient cycling? If I'm harvesting biomass, what does that mean for how I'm managing my nutrients? Do I need to add more potassium? Do I need to add more nitrogen? What's happening there? And another thing here is the habitat. Am I leaving some place for the pheasants to run and hide? So these are other larger issues that start coming into place. Now, I'm not going to try to address all of these. One of the strategies for getting at this is looking at carbon. This is a classic study by Bill Larson where you've got the amount of inputs, change in carbon, and when you get to here and you drop down, this is our minimum that you need to prevent the loss of soil carbon. Now what I did with some colleagues, and these are in two papers, and this is kind of summarizing it, is going through the literature, harvesting as many of these types of numbers as I could find, which wasn't nearly as many as I think I would like to have. And this is just looking at an example comparing what tillage does. In general, because of the impact of tillage on accelerating decomposition, you need more inputs when you're moldboard plow than compared to chisel plow. Now, don't take these as the final answer for everything, but look at it as an example. If you're in a corn soybean, you need to have more corn stover stay behind to make up for the small amount of biomass that's produced by the typical soybean. The other part of this is when you're moldboard plowing, you're not going to be controlling for erosion because you're only leaving about 5% of material to protect that soil. And depending on the type of conservation tillage you're using, you'll be somewhere in the 30 to 85%. So that's far more important in terms. So in terms of future examples, we're going to focus on being in a continuous corn or corn soybeans because now we know we're going to at least have a chance protecting for erosion. Here's an example if we're in Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana, or Illinois. These are maximum county yields. I kind of like to be the optimist. Let's look at, you know, the pie in the sky type thing. These are pretty impressive corn yields. These are in metric units. And we used about a 0.53 harvest index. So if we use 5.3 as the minimum amount of biomass we need to protect our soil organic matter, that means that we're leaving behind about two-thirds of the corn stalks and harvesting one-third to about 40%. I don't like to talk about percentages per se, but keep that in mind because I want to compare it to another example that's put out there. Percent is only good if you know what your absolute value is. Dr. Graham's study was referred to earlier. Very nice study. I got so excited when I seen this because she took it the next step. She didn't just say percent. She gave me an absolute, so I went, yahoo, I can compare her numbers with my numbers. I called her on the phone. We had a wonderful conversation. Got all excited. And the neat thing is that we can compare things. Now, she was being far more conservative than I am, and she was looking at averages over 95 to 2000. But if we come over here, when she took her two-thirds off, she's not leaving enough to protect my soil organic matter. I needed about five. So if we're managing, at least in these examples, to protect for erosion only, we're going to keep degrading our soil organic matter. This is a paper that came out, well, it's been accepted, it's in press, it should be out soon. I'm looking at my co-author back there and he's nodding, yeah, yeah, it'll be out soon. Where what we did is using the erosion models for water and for wind, made a comparison. We took our example for soil organic carbon, and the take-home message is that in all the examples that we looked at in this particular study, it takes more biomass to protect your soil organic carbon than for protecting for erosion. Conversely, if we're managing for carbon, provided we're not doing more board plowing and we're doing conservation tillage, we're going to protect for erosion too. That's a good thing to know. Another way of looking at it is, if I'm a farmer, and it would be really nice to have a whole collection of these, so a farmer could come along and go, I'm in this place, and my yield is 200 bushels to the acre, therefore I can come across here, I can now take 2 tons per acre of material, or the metric is on this side. That would be a wonderful place to be able to be. We're not quite there yet. One of the ways we're trying to get at this is I'm part of a national effort to try to answer this question. We've got scientists across the country setting out experiments or taking advantage of experiments that have been on the ground to try and get at that $6,400 question, how much is enough to protect our soil for organic matter and for erosion? And because it takes a long time to get these answers, we've also employed some folks that are really good at the modeling aspect of it. Because what we want to be able to come out of here is, how much do we need to stay on the land to protect the soil resource? We want to do this both in an environmental and an economic aspect, because it's really tough to be green when you're in the red, so that in the end we can provide recommendations and guidelines to policymakers as well as producers, because it's where the rubber hits the road is with our producers. And I'll leave it at that. I need to acknowledge my co-author, Dr. Wally Wilhelm, who's sitting in the back of the room, as well as some other folks that have helped along the way here. And at that, I'll wrap it up. Thank you very much.